Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
My mother was a genocide survivor. All my life, I promised to make a film who tell her story, how she suffered. And now we are making this film.
In Ararat, the film within the film of the same name, the actor Charles Aznavour portrays a famous director who blends poetic license with historical record to tell the story of the Armenian genocide. In Ararat, the actual film, Canadian filmmaker Adam Ogoyan does something similar, weaving together a labyrinthian plot in which present-day Canadians of Armenian descent struggle more than 9 decades after their ancestors' slaughter or narrow escape in eastern Turkey, struggle to understand. The film is as much about the memory of old atrocities as it is about the denial of them. Adam Ogoyan wanted it that way. It is, in a sense, a cinematic attempt to remedy a case of willful amnesia, to undo the forgetting that haunts the current generation of the Armenian diaspora. Connection listeners, here's a question for you. When a history lesson comes wrapped in cinema, what responsibility does the filmmaker have to tell all sides? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call to join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined now by Adam Ogoyan, the writer-director of the film, Arsene Kanjan. Kanjan. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Hi.
It was great, even the first time.
Even with my mispronunciations, Arsene.
Oh, it was good. It was close.
I want to make some space here, both of you, for people who have not seen the film. It's a complicated story. In a nutshell, a film about the people making a dramatic film about the Armenian genocide. I said a film within a film when I began the program. But these are all people who have one thing in common, if I'm not mistaken, that is that they're living with the memory, the aftermath of the Armenian genocide. Is that accurate? Mm-hmm.
I think so, yeah. And I also think it's also difficult when you try and summarize the plot of the film. Well, it sounds a lot more complex than it actually is as you're watching it, because as it unfolds, I think it's much more straightforward than any sort of breakdown would make it seem to be. And I think that one of the things that makes me cringe sometimes is when people try to summarize it. And it's not – I don't think it's necessary to do so, except, as you've said, you know, it's about the after effects and about the transmission of trauma from one generation to the other and about four different generations, survivors to children of survivors to grandchildren to great-grandchildren.
And also, I mean, what you just brought up, a very interesting question in terms of what is the role, the responsibility of the cinematic sort of endeavor to look at history and represent, as you said, all sides. I mean, given the complexity of history, if you were going into a history book, you would take the time to understand who all the players are and all the things that behind the scene or publicly have happened in history. In this case, I mean, the film is trying to express a personal sort of rendering on what memory and the effects of memory is. But of course, it is based on historical facts, and therefore, it does need a structure that at the outset might not seem as simple to recount. But as Adam said, once you go through it, you understand why it has to be that way.
I want to ask you about the film within the film, because there are those terrific moments when we think we're watching your film, Adam, and then we realize we're watching the film that's being made within the film that you're making. And that's a lovely sort of jar that you have for the audience. But the film that depicts the scenes of the Armenian genocide seems at times almost overdrawn, that there's too much smoke in the battle scene or too many bodies scattered around. And I know how delicate an artist you are with film. You've obviously done that on purpose.
Well, I thought it was very important to show those stories from the point of view of how, as children, we heard them. I think that I really wanted to convey that, you know, the Charles Aznavour character, Edward Saroyan, is someone who was raised with these stories. His mother was a survivor. And so when he finally gets the chance to represent them, I wanted to convey that he was actually seeing these stories and feeling the history in a certain way. And that sense of needing to tell it for the first time and trying to get it all there. And perhaps even to suggest that there is a tendency sometimes for survivors to exaggerate, especially when the story has been denied, when it's not an accepted truth, that when you have the chance to tell it, you make it over the top, you take it that extra step. And that's one of the things that the film is dealing with, because, as you know, there's, you know, the main character is a young man who's watching this production, who's, you know, working as a production assistant, and feels that there's something inauthentic about what he's seeing, that you know, in terms of how he understands his history, it doesn't seem entirely real.
Having said that, that doesn't discount in any way the veracity of the facts and what is being portrayed as death, as you know, crimes that we cannot possibly tolerate.
Absolutely
in our
not.
Societies.
No, I think you're right.
We were talking about in terms of the imagery that three generations later, when you're not there anymore to sort of experience it firsthand or know anymore, even the people who have gone through it, it's been passed on to you. You have to create a vivid image in your mind so that that responsibility is somehow to remember is alive. Anything more diluted than that, in the absence of any other recognition, would be impossible to remember. But this, I mean, when we talk about authenticity, or we talk about a heightened or exaggeration sort of representation, we're not talking about the facts that any of these scenes are portrayed.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say too that, as you know, the film within the film is based on a historic account by Clarence Usher, who's the main character who's depicted in Edward's film. And if you read his journals, I mean, the use of torture and the use of violence in this circumstance was really pronounced, and that's one of the most enduring legacies that as Armenian children that you're raised with, is just how extreme it all was. So,
but it would seem to me then, sorry, Adam, one of the real tasks or the dilemmas that you set up for yourself, both of you, is do you make the film for people who understand the story and can see through the subtleties, the devices, the overdrawing and the underplaying that you're talking about? And do you risk then taking all those other people who may not have ever heard of the Armenian genocide and leaving them just as puzzled as they were when they went in?
Sure, that's a risk, and that's the artistic risk the film takes. You know, I mean, I'm the first to understand that, and it was the only way I could tell the story. I needed to be able to recount the history, recount it in the way that it had been expressed to me, and certainly there's a side of me that is an Edward Saroyan. I mean, that there is a side that is aware of the brutality and was overwhelmed by the accounts that I've read and that I've heard about. But I do think that we are in a culture now that has a whole legacy of Holocaust films, and certainly in a culture that sees images not dissimilar from this daily on our televisions. There's nothing in the film, certainly, that the viewer has to contend with that they haven't actually seen in some form. And I am asking for the viewer to both involve themselves emotionally, but also to have a distance as well at the same time. I think that's absolutely essential. I think that especially when we're looking at this particular historic circumstance, whose defining and probably most identifiable feature is that it's been denied, that it is not easily referenced by most people.
Let's see if I can use just a short scene from the film to illustrate that. There's that moment when the young man, Rafi, is stopped by a customs agent, and the customs agent wants to know what's in the film canisters in Rafi's luggage, and Rafi explains, in a way, as part of a history lesson.
This is a letter of recommendation for future employment. Doesn't explain why you're returning from Turkey months later.
There was some stuff they wanted to add in Turkey. They added a character.
They?
Well, the director and the writer.
So who is this new character?
Arshil Gorky. The painter.
Turkish painter?
Armenian.
Now, why did you go to Turkey to shoot an Armenian painter?
Well, that's where he's from. He was born there. Armenia was historically part of Eastern Turkey. Anatolia.
And they sent you alone? Without a crew?
Well, yeah. They wouldn't have gotten permission to send a crew there.
Why not?
Well, it's not that easy to shoot a story about the Armenian genocide in Turkey. It's politically sensitive.
In what way?
Because the Turkish authorities don't want to admit it happened.
Arsene Kanjan, when I see you in the film next to the painting that Arshil Gorky did, which is what brings you in as the art history consultant on the film, though, I see a very powerful connection between you and the art and the story that's there. Did that precede your first look at the script? Was that something that you have known about for a long time?
Yes, we've known about Arshil Gorky's work for some time now. And, I mean, Arshil Gorky is the only famous survivor of the genocide who was able to somehow experience that past within his artistic creative process. So over the years, as we have discovered further and further his work, we have become really sort of fascinated by his journey. And somehow he's been very present for both Adam and myself as a of course, as an artist, but as an artist who also has shared this legacy that we have historically, and the subtle ways in which he has sort of included all these references. But the character of Ani is very interesting in that sense, because Arshil Gorky's work remains still quite unexplored. I mean, there are books now in terms of understanding what his references are and where his inspiration came from. But still, I mean, for a major artist of the 20th century, a very important part of his sort of work is still unanalyzed, if I may say. So this was an opportunity for sort of, in a way, to bring that also as a sort of a focus in terms of what that process of carrying a legacy and a heritage within the artistic expression somehow could mean for survivors.
The illustration of the artist's mother's face is so powerful. It was new to me in the film. We used it on our website to mark this show, Adam, just because there's such strength in the portrait that he's done.
Well, it's, to me, the most haunting legacy of this whole history, I think. And it's the most moving testament to it.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And my guest this hour, the writer, director, and producer of the film Ararat, Atom Magoyan, Arsene Kanjan, is also with us. She's the actor, star of Ararat, we're interested in hearing your view about the place of cinema in history and particularly the way that stories can be used, mixing together history with characters and bringing to light things that aren't perhaps that well known. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by ColorTech, photographic and digital processing.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon.
Young man, do you know what still causes so much pain? It's not the people we lost. Or the land. It's to know that we could be so hated.
That's the actor, Charles Aznavour, who plays Edward Saroyan, the fictional director of the film within the film in Adam Egoyan's new movie, Ararat. Adam Egoyan is with us, as is Arsene Kanjan, the actor who stars in the film. And you are both of Armenian descent. I'm I'm interested in hearing from you if this was a difficult film to make. You listen to a moment like that that Charles evokes, or that you all sort of collectively evoke, and wonder if there were times when people just needed to walk away from the set, get a breath of fresh air.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the film was full of those moments. I mean, I think what was most difficult for me was just this idea that this recreation was the closest we'd ever come to going back. I mean, there was no evidence that exists there, really, of the life that had been there before. And so when we populated these street scenes with Armenian extras from the community here, and or when we were, you know, marching through the deserts, you know, for the scenes of the deportations, it was extraordinarily painful at moments. First of all, just to understand what the physicality of that was, what it means to actually be in that type of heat, and to be walking, to see our extra is actually suffering from heat stroke, you know, and realizing that at one level, you know that that happened, that people were marched through deserts, but to see physically what that means, and to involve people in scenes which reflected in some way, no matter how artificial it might have seemed, what happened to their ancestors, what happened to their grandparents or great-grandparents. It's an act of incarnation, and I think the film touches on that too, the strange separation between something that you're filming that you know is a set, that you know is make-believe, but it's also, in the process, the closest you will come to physically understanding what that space is like in a three-dimensional way. And filmmaking offers that. It's one of the strange elements of what filmmaking does. I've noticed this a number of times with other projects as well that I've done, that when you actually have a set and you populate it with people, the lines begin to blur. And that's something which is both compelling, but also quite disorienting as well.
I mean, it did take on sort of the feeling of being a commemorative ritual in that sense. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, having a film about the Armenian genocide and its effects on its descendants, and being sort of produced in such a mainstream way, I guess it involved so many people with so many stories untold that gathered on that set often. It would have been very interesting. Unfortunately, we don't really have a documentation of that, to make just a sort of documentary about what, you know, all these participants, extras or other actors from Armenian descent were going through, because we each had incredibly private moments, moments that we could not express, but anymore in words, but for the first time we were experiencing. I mean, I remember walking into the set the first time. I had not seen the city of Van sort of built up as it was. And I had the most cathartic moment of my life in a way, because I thought this is the closest I will ever come to reality that belonged to my ancestors, to the heritage that I carry, to the history that I am sort of descendant of. And this is the last time I will see it, as the city of Van eventually was, or the town of Van was also sort of destroyed in the film. I knew that it was going to be exactly what it has been for 87 years. No reference is going to be remaining there except a picture, a film in that sense. And I was in tears. I couldn't understand exactly why I was sort of completely at such level of joy and despair at the same time, because this was something that completely unexpected.
All right, let's move to some of our callers here. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to Salem, Oregon, and Barbara's joining us. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a second generation Armenian, and I have to tell you that I am thrilled beyond belief that this movie has been made. My entire life, I grew up with the legacy, my grandparents going through the genocide and hearing these stories. And I'm so pleased that you're doing this.
But if you were raised with the stories and know them, Barbara, why is it that what Adam and Arsene are doing is so important to you?
Because there are so few Armenians left in the world. And my grandmother just died about 4 years ago. And once she was gone, now that both of my grandparents are gone, that history is starting to end because I was raised here. And so most Americans, many people in the world, don't know what happened to us. And it's so important that they know this, just like the Jewish genocide.
And do you think that, Barbara, is because the Turks have denied that the genocide took place? Is that the reason why, or is it also have to do with the placement in history and the fact that everyone else had their own memories of the First World War? What's your sense of that?
Well, of course, you know, the Turks denied it, but it's not just the Turks. It's the American government, because we did acknowledge that there were problems with the Armenians and the Turks long before World War I. But nothing was ever completely done. It was acknowledged, but nothing was ever completely taken care of. And these Armenian people were just left, like she said, to wander in the desert. And that's what my grandmother did.
Adam Arsene.
Well, I mean, it's very important to sort of, yes, contextualize what you're saying.
Because I think that what's important to understand is that the American denial is astonishing given, and Western denial, it's not just America, because all of the West was intimately aware of what was happening at this period. And after the First World War, there was an internal tribunal in Turkey by the provisional government, which actually convicted all of the leaders of the Young Turk government, the Itais government, which set out the blueprint for this genocide. What happened, though, in the years following was breathtakingly cynical. The West understood the full extent of the former Ottoman Empire, which extended down to present-day Israel and over to the oil fields of Saudi Arabia. And the oil interest became so predominant in the Western sort of thinking that the new Turkish government of Kemal Atatürk was able to negotiate with the West that they would make these oil fields available in return for a complete dropping of the findings of this trial. And this, you know, accounts for this incredible shift between 1919 with the Treaty of Sèvres, in which Armenian sufferings were acknowledged and where there was land that was being returned under the auspices of this treaty. And what happens with the Treaty of Sèvres 5 years later, where this is completely turned around. So it's a breathtakingly cynical gesture where, if you look at newspaper accounts from 1915, 1916 in the West, it was front page news. People from that generation still remember this notion of the Armenian, starving Armenians. It was an expression, and everyone, it was very much in the public consciousness. Then there was a concerted effort to re-educate the population, to diminish what happened, and certainly to try and deny the extent of it. And
Adam, let me just interrupt you there if I can. Yeah. I want to thank Barbara for her call and move on if I can. Keith's on the line, joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Keith.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I wanted to thank both of you for this really marvelous film, and it was just so evocative. It brought to mind sort of powerful memories of a trip my Lebanese-Armenian wife and I took to eastern Anatolia, to Ani and Van and Ahtamar. And let me just preface this by saying I'm an Ottoman historian who actually teaches, one of the few who teaches the Armenian Genocide and integrates it into my research and into my teaching. And that brings up, I mean, an issue I'd like you both to try to respond to, which is by hinging this movie so thoroughly on memory and the contingent nature of memory itself and remembrance, I worry that you may be playing into the hands of those who would deny the Armenian Genocide and merely say, well, that's just how the Armenians remember it. This is the way it really happened. And this seems inconsistent with some of the other movies things like Shoah in the whole repertoire of Holocaust films, in which witness is accepted as true. And if you could just respond to that, that would be great.
It's a very, very provocative point, and I think that I take this as irrefutable and an absolute given. Made sure that there is nothing in the film that could be contested historically. That being said, the experience of how it exists in the present is very much filtered through this position of denial. So the challenge was, on the one hand, to present material which was factual, which is, as it's stated in the film, it's everything is based on a historic account of Clarence Usher, which it was published as a book, not to mention, countless other archives that any viewer can resource. But also taking that as a given, to then move to what to me is a more interesting issue from the present-day perspective, which is how denial affects the psychology of these people. I understand what you're saying in terms of it, the risk, but I'm also assuming a degree of intelligence on the part of the viewer and a curiosity to resource material. As was said at the beginning, there is a lot of history that's actually expressed in the film, but short of using title cards and making it a documentary, I really couldn't go further whilst being true to my own voice. I mean, being true to the type of work I do. It would have been great if there was a more straightforward, account of this film that had been presented before, but unfortunately that wasn't the case.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by New Life Drama Company, presenting Ebenezer Scrooge, A Christmas Carol, a musical adaptation of Dickens' classic Christmas story, December 14th through the 22nd. NewLifeFineArts.org. Sugarloaf USA, featuring ski terrain for all abilities, with 129 trails, including lift serviced above treeline skiing. 1-800-THE-LOAF. And Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, now accepting reservations for a special New Year's dinner featuring an a la carte and prefix menu. Information at 617-720-5511.
Here on The Connection, we bring you familiar voices with new insights. Literary comment by Senator John McCain.
I think that Hemingway will be remembered for his incredible style.
Political criticism by Kurt Vonnegut.
I am afraid that I am like Joe Heller. Joe Heller never voted. He didn't want to be complicit.
I'm Dick Gordon. This morning we're asking for your help, your support, your pledge to help us bring you compelling guests with great stories to tell. So please, phone now.
Call now at 1-800-909-9287 and join your thousands of fellow listeners of yours in supporting the station that you're listening to right now and that good program, The Connection.
We've had a terrific outpouring of support from listeners just like you at 1-800-909-9287. The fundraiser wraps up tomorrow, though, and we still have a goal of $153,000, which we can make, but only if we hear from you. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call, or if it's more convenient for you, you can pledge online at our secure website, wbur.org.
Pledge to help pay for the news, for the information that is so important to you as you make your way through the day. You know, coming up on Here and Now at noon, we're going to get a report on the Turkish ambassador meeting with President Bush and Condoleezza Rice, and possibly this question being discussed right now by Dick Gordon and his guest. The Armenian genocide may come up, and it may not, but the important thing is that you're going to know what's going on, not only in Washington, but around the world, and to do that, we need your help. 1-800-909-9287, $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 if you can. The important thing is that you call now.
We need your help because we only get about 8% of our funding from the government. Half of all that we get for funding comes from listeners just like you. So you really make a difference when you call and make that pledge at 1-800-909-9287. And it's really important that we make this goal before the fundraiser ends tomorrow because we won't have to add these funds we may not have gotten in this fundraiser to the next time we ask you for money, with our next subsequent fundraiser. So help us make this goal so we have the resources for you 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call.
You'll be joining folks like Ned Nomina, partnering with financial companies to transform business challenges into viable e-solutions in Boston and New York, on the web at nednomina.com, and Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. We're grateful to our corporate funders, but listeners just like you account for more than half of what it takes to keep WBUR coming day after day with Morning Edition, The Connection, the BBC World Service, Here and Now at Noon, Fresh Air. I could go on and on and on because this programming goes on and on and on. But we need your help to keep it coming.
1-800-909-9287. Oh, here's something else, too. Everyone who calls, when you call right now, you will be eligible for the drawing to go to a Bruins Maple Leafs game with Dick Gordon, our fellow who's from Toronto, as a matter of fact. He's torn. He's not going to know who to root for, but you know who to root for, and that's the connection in WBUR when you make that pledge at 1-800-909-9287, and you'll get entered in the drawing.
And that's always a great game. The Bruins, in fact, are atop the division now, the Toronto Maple
Leafs. They're
hot. They always play a tough game, and Dick Gordon will be right there with you, and he's an expert on hockey as well as a lot of other things, including the program that comes your way 2 hours each day and that you're listening to right now. Won't you call and pledge a support at 1-800-909-9287 or pledge on the web at WBUR.org for the variety of programming that keeps you interested, aware, and informed.
1-800-909-9287 is the number to call to pledge for programs like The Connection, to pledge for Here and Now that's coming up. Remember, you pay half the cost of the bills here at WBUR, and we want to make it convenient for you, too. You can make your contribution all in one lump sum, or maybe it's easier for you to have it done month by month. You can have it deducted from your credit card or added to your credit card. You can have it deducted from your checking account. Whatever's easier for you, but you'll be helping to pay for the news that's important to you, that keeps you coming back every day. Pay for this service by calling 1-800-909-9287.
Or pledge on the web at WBUR.org. You know, the more you can do for us, the more we can do for you. And WBUR has a reputation for seeing a need and filling it and then saying, hey, how about helping us out? And I'm thinking of On Point with Tom Ashbrook. Did not exist until the tragedy of 9/11 and has ever since, and is important in this time of changing news and updated material. Tom's doing a great job keeping people updated, and thanks.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program today, Arsene Kanjin. She is actor, star of Ararat. Arsene was born to Armenian parents living in Beirut, Lebanon, moved to Montreal when she was 17. Adam Agoyan, the writer, director, and producer of Ararat, was born in Cairo, raised in Victoria, British Columbia, also of Armenian descent. And the two have been working together on a number of projects since they got together. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This is a conversation about the latest film, Ararat. And we're going to Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Mike's joining us. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I'm of Armenian descent, and I would like to hear the perspective of Adam on the magnitude of this event in terms of its effect on the collective Armenian psyche. I mean, it happened 85 years ago, but it still dominates the Armenian psyche today. And I think it's more than just a matter of denial on the part of certain people. I think it's the magnitude of the event, and I wish he would comment about the severity and magnitude of this event affecting so many people to such a great degree, and how it could still filter through several generations 85 years later.
Mm-hmm. Adam.
Wow, that's a big question. I mean, I think what's most obvious is that the first people that were eliminated were our intellectuals, our artists, and our leaders. And I think that, you know, the Armenian community is still dealing with this issue of trying to somehow find a sense of its own path and its own leadership. You know, we are still torn by this incredible blank in our psyche. You know, an entire culture and political system was decimated. We are, I can say very proudly, a very, very resourceful people. We have done extraordinary things in the diaspora. But I think haunting all of us is the sense of what we might have been if we were still a collective unit.
So
and
when,
that is something. Yeah.
Sorry, Adam, I was just going to ask you to sort of take it to the next step. If, as Mike's implying, that it is the one of the preoccupying features of Armenians two generations removed from that moment today, mm-hmm. will it continue to be for your children and for your grandchildren, in your view?
That's, again, a very, very complex question. It really depends on how we raise them and how in what circumstances we want them to be raised. I mean, the upbringing I had was very different from the upbringing Arsene had. And it's the community has a system of raising children not to ever forget this, and it's very, very valuable. But there are many Armenian families that have a very assimilationist view.
Arsene,
we are divided as a people.
Let me ask you on this, Arsene, because I know that a number of Jews living in America put their support behind a project called Remembering History, where, mm-hmm. you know, it's very important that the Holocaust not be forgotten, not in any way to sort of wallow in that horrible moment, but to make sure that those things don't happen, that people see the seeds of them coming before they can.
That those things don't happen, and they don't happen again, not only to us, but to everyone else as well. The reason I feel that our son has to know about this history is not only, I mean, you know, history like everything else, we don't have the luxury sometimes to just pass on the glory of it. I mean, history is filled with horrible sort of examples of human behavior, but that is our lineage to, you know, where we come from, where we are, and where we will be. So I consider very important to remember, not necessarily in the, you know, with the weight sometimes that memory carries. I mean, I know that as a third generation Armenian, a second generation Armenian, I guess, I had to do certain things because my parents expected, my grandparents expected from me. Now, you know, I do not feel that was a burden on my life as long as I understood why as a human being I had to sort of implement that. And it's something that I consider, as I was saying earlier, as a civic responsibility. Remembering history is a wonderful tool that individuals have in order to become full participants in society and shaping history to improve it, hopefully. So it's not a burden for me, as long as we know why and in what context. I mean, it's not sort of discrimination or intolerance mm-hmm. that we are sort of proposing. It's more to open up in a larger way to see the world. I mean, it has shaped my view, the knowledge of my history, the genocide. So I assume that could be a positive sort of experience if it's properly.
Let me go back to Mike in Oshkosh and Mike ask just how it plays out in your family. Are you a father? Is this something that you talk to your children about?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm a second generation Armenian, and I think it's very interesting that this film is being made now. I think the pain was so great amongst the first generation Americans, my father's generation, that they couldn't even talk about it. They were the children of the survivors, and it's kind of interesting. My grandmother spoke to me and my brother and sister and about the genocide, and so I had conversations with her, yet I never had a conversation with my father. And I think that the pain that he probably witnessed as he was growing up as a kid made his generation almost clam up, and they didn't even speak about it. So I think some of the literature and some of the movies that are being made now by Armenians are being made by the generation that's you know, additional generation removed from the atrocities.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that, Mike, that there were attempts to make movies by some of the large picture houses in Hollywood, which were squashed by political pressure back in the 30s. So it's not a first attempt, but it's certainly one that has its history in motion picture making. Thanks a lot for your call.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Aishe, who's joining us now from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Aishe.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I guess you figured at some point a Turkish person would call.
It crossed my mind.
Yeah. I just wanted to say I by no means at any point support any mass of people being murdered or butchered. But I just wanted to say from a perspective of a Turkish citizen, a younger Turkish citizen, there's always, unfortunately, two sides to a story. And I think a lot of times, as a Turkish person, the word we do not like to have used is genocide, in that from the perspective of the Ottoman Empire, and I'm not saying the Turkish Republic because that didn't actually end up forming until 1923, genocide is when you blatantly kill a group of people just because they are of a certain race in the case of, we talk about the Holocaust, but we also hear lots of stories of our grandparents who lived at that time who were actually friends with the Armenians, where everybody lived together and actually protected the Armenians. But at the same time, there were Armenians that did very bad things to the Turkish people or the, you know, people of the Ottoman Empire. And actually, even the people that helped them later on said, you know, we will come back and kill all of your children or do whatever we can to hurt you. And unfortunately, this was a time of war, where in the time of war, the Ottoman Empire was in a way trying to protect itself. And again, I'm not saying that bad things did not happen, but I think it is important to sort of put a perspective, and I don't like it when there's this hatred that constantly comes about in terms of remember this genocide, without...
And is it all rooted in hatred? In your view, I should.
I definitely believe so. In terms of a lot of reactions I've gotten from Armenian people, as soon as they hear that I'm Turkish, even though I have absolutely no, nothing against Armenians, I feel bad about anything that might have happened. But like I said, from when we think of it from the Turkish point of view, it was a time of war, and unfortunately.
Actually, let me ask if I can get my my guests in on this. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
I'm Kyle Chowinski from Brimfield, Massachusetts. I'm trying to think the right words to say, just how much I appreciate your station as far as such a neutral, open format. All the other talk radio stations offer nothing but vicious propaganda, like very biased. What your radio station presents is the honest truth, and you can't buy that anywhere. So you have to stay on the air, please.
Well, thanks, Kyle. We'll sure try to do that, and we can do that with the help of folks like you, Kyle, and others who have called 1-800-909-9287 and made a contribution to help out our year-end fundraiser, which ends tomorrow, by the way.
Tomorrow is the day. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call. Yes, Ted, tomorrow the fundraiser ends. And, as Kyle said, it's an open forum. It's both sides of any issue. That's what you get when you tune to The Connection. And listeners just like you are an integral part with your phone calls. You're equally as integral a part when you call now and help pay for it, because listeners pay half the cost of all the programs and all the news that we give you here day in and day out at WBUR. So here's your chance to help out, 1-800-909-9287. And let me remind you, when you do call right now, you will be eligible for the drawing to go to a Bruins-Toronto game with none other than Dick Gordon. So don't miss out on that and call now.
That's right. It's not all about issues. It's about enjoyment, too. And our programming reflects that, and so does Dick Gordon, as he deals with a whole spectrum of topics on The Connection. We're funded by you, our listeners. You make it possible. And by ThoughtForms, custom builders located in Acton, celebrating 30 years of building new houses, renovations, and additions. ThoughtForms. And Minnelli Incorporated, a branding, print, and design firm providing innovative solutions to help organizations differentiate themselves and succeed in today's marketplace. On the web at minelli.com. As well as Zebra's Bistro and Wine Bar in Medfield, the 2001 recipient of Boston Magazine's Best of Boston Award for Best New Restaurant West of Boston. Information at zebrasbistro.com.
Now, if you were sitting there listening to Kyle, the listener, a few moments ago and nodding your head like, yeah, well, make a pledge right now for programs like The Connection. It's why you keep coming back. But remember, we need your help to pay for programs like The Connection, because listeners do pay half the cost of the station here at WBUR. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call.
That's right. And coming up next on Here and Now at noon, we're going to get reports on Turkey's leader, Tayyip Erdogan, meeting with President Bush and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Reports from Venezuela on the crisis there. The anti-Chavez strike is deepening. We'll be talking to the web philosopher David Weinberg about a congressional proposal to control the Internet. A report on how the U.S. has arranged to get sole copy of the report on Iraqi weapons, and some of the members of the Security Council are angry about that. All of these cost a certain amount of money to bring those reports to you, as we do every day at noon on Here and Now. That's why we're asking you to step up, as listeners have done in the past, with $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever you can do, at 1-800-909-9287, on the web at WBUR.org.
And if you can use a credit card, that's great, too. We can put the money to work right away, paying for the news. 1-800-909-9287.
All year long, you've been able to count on WBUR for thorough coverage and thoughtful analysis of any number of stories. And as a reminder of how much you've learned from listening, let's listen back to some of the stories we brought you.
At least 11 people were killed today and scores wounded when a Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up on a bus in Jerusalem during morning rush hour.
There was confusion in the small emergency room as victims of the blast lay on stretchers in the hall and family members raced in looking for their relatives. 17-year-old Lonnie Gino looked dazed as she held a conference.
Several hundred friends and relatives have come to the cemetery to say goodbye. The black-draped coffins are wheeled in on gurneys, one full-size, one small. On top of both are bouquets of white roses. Chen Kanaan pushes herself out of the wheelchair. She rests her forearms on her daughter's...
As Israelis gathered at funerals for some of the seven victims of the latest suicide bombs...
Now, those are just a couple of examples of the stories we brought you on the conflict in the Middle East, stories paid for from contributions from listeners like you. You can continue this coverage with a contribution now at 1-800-909-9287, or you can go online at WBUR.org. But let me just say that those stories have length and depth because this is the only place that will give them the time to help with real understanding of events.
And we're able to do that from generous support from fellow listeners who've already called 1-800-909-9287. I'm thinking, Ted, how you mentioned coming up in Here and Now, they're going to be covering the anti-Chavez strike in Venezuela. Now, you will get the latest on that situation with Here and Now. Coming up tonight, On Point, that is also the subject of one of their hours. So while On Point is being brought to you, producers of On Point with Tom Ashbrook are tracking the story. They will then give you the latest tonight when On Point comes on. You'll have a chance to call in. And that's how it goes. We track.